It's hard to believe that we have been having in-depth weekly conversations about movies since 2011.
So many great conversations over the years about so many great movies. All that said, producing this show week after week requires a ton of work behind the scenes.
Becoming a Next Reel member gives you access to all sorts of additional and exclusive content. Plus, you're helping us keep the lights on. Just head to thenextreel.com/membership, where you can learn more about becoming a member, which costs a measly $5 a month, practically the same as one fancy coffee drink. And you get so much more.
Every month, we record a bonus episode exclusively for members. Those episodes cover movies from whatever series we're covering at the moment, or add to previous series.
Some movies we've covered that only members get to hear us discuss include The Blues Brothers,
The Russia House,
Naked Lunch,
Independence Day,
The Hot Rock,
and Relic, the better one. Plus, members get to vote on what we're going to discuss for those episodes.
We also record additional pre- and post-show content in regular episodes that only members get to hear.
Like conversations about similarly themed movies.
And answering listener questions from our live member chat.
Speaking of our live member chat, we record almost all of our episodes in Discord, where members can chat right along with us live.
Members get access to other members-only channels in our Discord community as well. On top of all that, members get all episodes a full week earlier than everyone else in a private Next Reel feed just for them that includes all the shows in the Next Reel family. The Next Reel, The Film Board,
Movies We Like, Sitting in the Dark, and more new projects on the way.
To top it all off, members don't have to listen to ads. We've already eliminated those annoying, dynamically inserted ads that, let's face it, we all hate it.
We are listening to you.
We love podcasting for a living, and those ads help to pay the bills. Now, we're counting on you, dear listener.
We promise. We aren't going back to those terrible, dynamically inserted ads that don't relate to us at all. All we ask is that you consider supporting the Next Reel family of podcasts with a membership.
Again, it's $5 per month or $55 per year. Just head to thenextreel.com/membership.
thenextreel.com/membership. Get your access to early, ad-free episodes with bonus content, member bonus episodes, and access to member channels and live streams in Discord by signing up today. I'm Pete Wright.
And I'm Andy Nelson.
Welcome to The Next Reel. When the movie ends,
our conversation begins.
The American Astronaut is over. It's my birthday!
Guess who this is?
The boy who actually saw a woman's breast.
A birthday boy. He kills without reason.
You ready, Cat?
The American Astronaut, Andy. Wow. How the hell are we talking about this movie?
This is the benefit of putting this season together with some of these series where, for particular reasons, not knowing some of the films that were in them. I guarantee that in this particular series that we're doing the 2002 Independent Spirit Award nominees for Best Cinematography. And I think, we're going to be looking at The American Astronaut, The Deep End, Hedwig and the Angry Inch. We've already talked about Memento before, but we'll rebroadcast that episode. And then we're ending with Mulholland Drive. And Mulholland Drive is the film that we were kind of building this series around. What was it nominated for? What could we potentially find as a series? And we landed on this one because we also wanted to talk in our scope of different awards. We hadn't talked about the Film Independent Spirit Awards yet. So we're like, they're an important one to discuss and look at as far as independent films. And in the process of putting this together, we end up with something like The American Astronaut on our list, which is, I'd say, a big win, because neither of us, I don't know how else this would have ended up on the show if neither of us had never seen this one before, but I'm glad it was here.
Yes, an extraordinary, extraordinary find. Okay, so the film follows the adventures of an interplanetary trader named Samuel Curtis, who is on a mission to provide the all female population of Venus with a suitable male. And on his way there, there are a number of handoffs that he has to make, including James Ransone in a gimp outfit. And that is incredible. It's incredible.
Whose name is Bodysuit.
The movie is very low budget. It has vibes of another find that it was a result of the Movie by Minute community. Dave Made a Maze, which I kept thinking about watching this movie. It's like David Lynch, Dave Made a Maze, Ad Astra Per Asperum, the Soviet science fiction film we watched. Like, there are vibes of this sort of...
Oh, well, and you have to throw Dark Star in there, too.
And Dark Star, of course. Which we talked
about earlier this season, yeah.
Yeah. So it puts a bunch of things together, but it does it in a really surprising way, right? As a science fiction sort of musical Western comedy, it also has some low-key beautiful filmmaking in it. It's black and white, 35mm, shot in 35mm, and...
Stark black and white.
Stark black and white, and it is... It's just really beautiful to watch, right? Am I alone? I was entranced by the imagery.
It's beautiful to watch, and which made it all the more frustrating that the the existing version that seems to be, I mean, they released it on DVD. So if you can find a DVD, it's probably worth holding on to. But otherwise, it is like, it's on YouTube at 240p. So let me tell you, trying to watch that on an 85-inch TV isn't the best way. It's not the best way to do it.
Blocky. Blocky is the word the kids use. It's blocky.
It's mushy. Yeah.
Mushy. Oh, God.
But still, take that aside. When you get a sense as to what they were creating with the images in this, it's they crafted something. I think they did a really incredible job of allowing the low budget nature of the film to not end up getting in the way of what the production looked like. And by, you know, in space, it's Stark, you've got one source of light. And so when he lands on Ceres, the asteroid, to go to the bar, and you have that fantastic shot of his shadow, and then eventually him kind of, you know, slow hopping across the asteroid to get to the bar. It's just this fantastic, like, one backlight across a tiny swath of land as you kind of see it happening. And just the way that they crafted the shots, came up with the framing and everything to allow for something really simple to come across in a creative way and not have to worry about, well, it's going to look cheap if we do it this way on because we don't have a huge budget. Like, they just found ways around problems and made something wholly unique.
For sure. For sure. I think that is a great example. That entry to the bar is such a great example, because it has such throes of, like, first, obviously, David Lynch, but Paul Thomas Anderson, Wes Anderson, like, I'm seeing framing and jumping from weird close-ups to weird backlighting to the hopping shadow that creeps into the frame. Like, there are so many influences in this movie. I was getting fritzed out watching it. I was like, oh my God, now it's them. Now it's, it was too much. It was like too many signals. And then, of course, we get to the music, which is, it's got some hooks. I found myself legit singing songs from this movie. It is a musical movie.
You know, I haven't looked for the soundtrack, but now I want to see.
I couldn't find it.
See, it's a lot of really great tunes that were just quirky, fun. In some ways, this film reminded me of... So when Steve and JJ talked about the history of Future Folk on the Trailer Rewind podcast, this reminded me of that. It is a strange, like, low budget sci-fi comedy musical, you know, and that one's color, this one's black and white, that one's on Earth, this is traveling across space, but they both have that feel. And there was something in both films that I just enjoyed so much, with kind of that nature of doing something, of like having this sense of a musical that, you know, doesn't tick the boxes of what you normally expect, but works so incredibly well. Like, these songs, you're right, they all incredibly memorable. Now, Corey McAbee, the writer director of this, has more of a musical background, and you've been listening to some of his work. Do you know, like, did you do much exploration as far as?
Well, there's not a whole, it's weirdly, there's not a whole lot on like Apple Music. And, you know, I looked for both him and his band, The Billy Nair Show. That is his band. And they did, that's who is credited with the music for the movie, is The Billy Nair Show. So I listened to the EP Glory Days. Well, it's the Glory Days soundtrack, and there are some Billy Nair songs on there, at least one of them, Baby. I also listened to You by the Billy Nair Project, and Piggy's Got the Conch. And most, this is on the EP Rudy and Grace by Corey McAbee, which is delightful sort of self-improvement. It's really just reminding you that Piggy's got the conch over and over and over again, and you are amazing over and over and over again in a retro synth kind of style. So there isn't a lot of music to choose from, and I found that incredibly disappointing, because I would love to, I think, listen especially to this soundtrack. Like, I would love to be able to put this on, this weirdo movie on, and just listen to.
The music is a lot of fun, and you know, it's just quirky, weird songs that because of the way they crafted the story end up fitting, you know, where the vibe is, I mean, you know, we're in the science fiction world, you know, he's traveling to the asteroid Ceres, and then he has to travel to Jupiter. It's very fictional, obviously, no one's going to be landing on Jupiter, but, and then going to Venus, and eventually with plans to go to Earth. But it is very much a Western, and it is about a guy who, you know, cuts deals and makes all these plans and is basically taking packages and making deliveries for people. And that's his job. But it's done in a way where he feels kind of like that loner in the old West, kind of getting these things done. He goes to this first bar that feels very much kind of an old West bar. There's a musical dance contest. You've got, you know, like some things that start getting thrown in there. And so once you get a sense of this is the world we're in, it's not a surprise when two thugs walk into the bathroom when he's taking a crap and oh, do God, a dance number outside of the stall, then take his picture and then leave. Like, it, that wasn't a surprise. It's like, this is the world that we're in. It's very strange. And same thing when you get to Jupiter and you have the whole performative nature of Johnny R up on the stage in front of everybody talking about like the boy who saw a breast, you know, and he's kind of like the one man who actually had seen a woman's breast when he was young. And, you know, getting to the Venus and the song Girl with a Vagina Made of Glass, it's all like, by the time we're there, I'm like, yeah, of course we're going to have a song like this, because yeah, it just fits this strange thing with his wolf howls and everything.
Well, and look at his travel. I think that's a really, the way he travel is depicted in this movie is a real highlight for me, because, you know, it's a movie, obviously no budget. There's very little money going into this movie. And yet, the way the special effects are handled, I think we get some movement of miniatures, but the in-space stuff is generally done with stills that are crossfading between one another across a frame and sound effects. And I thought that was really effective. Again, because I'm already in a world with thugs who dance in a bathroom, that by the time I'm seeing the act of science fiction in traveling in space happen, I totally buy into it. I was absolutely on board for all of this. I didn't miss any sort of flashy pyrotechnics at all. It just, I was in universe.
Yeah, we kind of skip all of that, which worked for me. I think the closest we get is when you get a shot of it looks like a firecracker, like flying across a sky in the distance. As I think this is when he's landing on Jupiter, or on, is it Jupiter or Venus? I want to say it's Venus when he's coming in for a landing there. And then you never see any of it. And the inside of his rocket looks like a kitchen with a little place to sit, you know, when you're piloting, like a kitchen / bedroom. Like it's not...
It's like the worst motorhome.
Yeah, right. It's just the smallest little thing. And it just, it kind of it kind of plays okay. You know, like, I'm not worried that it's something that looks like the inside of the Nostromo or something. Like, it just, it feels very just lowbrow in the way that they're crafting it, and it ends up working perfectly. I mean, they go to, you know, this bar that's on an asteroid. Like, none of this stuff makes sense. There's a floating barn, you know, like, partway through the film that he hides in.
Right.
Again, like, very Western.
It's very Western. And look at, like, the opening sequence again, back to the hopping across the landscape to get into the bar in the first place. I think this is a really interesting sleight of hand, that the door to get into the airlock is just a door, right? There's nothing airlocky about it. And you might stop and think, well, that's ridiculous, low budget stuff. Like, who's going to believe that? Nobody believes that. But that's okay, because there's a paper sign on the outside of the door that says dance contest tonight, which is so funny that it completely distracts me from the fact that this is a bonkers movie. Like, I honestly think if there hadn't been that sign on the door, I might have stopped to question the veracity of a regular door as an airlock door for this thing. Like, you couldn't spring for a curved bezel around the door to make it look more like a submarine door. They didn't need to, because we're in a universe that's just funny. I mean, this is an example of a movie that has some exceptional world building that I just get behind.
Yeah, I'm completely there. Like, they set up very simply this alternate version of our solar system, where something has happened and women are on Venus now, but it's a very particular group of women. The story about why they need a man periodically is great. Like, the women don't need men anymore, but they can't just breed with themselves, because after a certain number of generations, even they get too snippy for the women to deal with.
It's every three generations.
It's very funny.
Which is weird, because right after I watched this movie, I watched Midsommar, which has a very similar vibe.
Yeah, right. So all the women are on Venus, but men in this universe seem to be kind of largely everywhere else. Like, in this asteroid bar that we go hang out at, there are no women. Everybody imagines what a woman must be like, and it's like this ideal image that they have in their head. And that's why all of these miners on Jupiter, that's why the guy who runs the mine keeps the boy who saw a breast around, because he's like the highlight. He comes out and does this whole show just to talk about what a breast is like. And so you're setting up this strange universe or strange solar system, but it all made sense. And it didn't require a lot of exposition either. Like, it was fairly simple as far as the way that they kind of gave us the points as far as who's where, what's going on, these trades that had to be made and everything. And I got it. Like, it was a very simple world building done in a way that made sense. And it worked.
Yeah, I think so too. They do have for a movie that has such a dalliance with the science fiction-y part, the science part of science fiction, the bathroom, I think there are some nods when he says things like, do you have a bathroom I can use? And the bartender says, yeah, it's a real toilet, so be careful. Right? Like, yeah. I guess, of course, that's problematic in space. They were at least acknowledging that, like, we're trying to make a space show, and probably if you thought too hard about it, it wouldn't work the way you think it's going to work. But I was okay. That's just another example of being sold on the universe. Can we talk about the antagonist?
Peculiar antagonist that's also the narrator of the film, and that's actually an element that I want to talk about a little bit too, but yeah, let's talk about our antagonist for a little bit first.
So this is Rocco Sisto as Professor Hess. The way I understand it is he's upset with our principal gunslinger because he wasn't wished a happy birthday, and so he's chasing him down to get a happy birthday out of him.
I don't think that's why. It sounds like he's okay killing anybody as long as, what did he say? As long as he had kind of forgiven them or something like that. I can't remember the thing. And that was the thing. Like, he's perpetually chasing Curtis, here it is. He's capable of killing only without reason. He can't have any conflict or unresolved issues with your intended victim. He is pursuing Curtis in order that he might forgive him. And then once that happens,
he'll be able to kill him.
Then he'll be able to kill him because he can only kill without reason.
I don't know if it's even fair to ask this question, but I'm going to try it. How does that sit with you?
In the scope of this world, it really was fine.
It doesn't matter at all.
Yeah. It's such a strange thing. I mean, I absolutely delighted in seeing him use his, I don't know, disintegration gun, I guess. Like, it made me go back to the...
I'm so glad there's a disintegration gun.
Oh my gosh. What were they in Captain America, the First Avenger, when we talked about that on Marvel Movie Minute? We had the rotor marks in the... when Red Skull was blasting everybody, we had the piles and the marks.
Yes, right. The blue goo smears.
Yeah, rotor marks and Schneider piles.
Is what Schneider we piles. Schneider yeah. piles. Outstanding. Who comes up with this stuff? So, right. Yeah, I thought that was a really clever bit, and he's constantly like wiping it off, but he carries it. It's not like he's wiping it off for fingerprints. He keeps putting it away. I don't know why he keeps wiping it off.
Well, and is he wiping it off because it gets the dust on it? But then he's rolling around in the dust and kicking it when he gets to Jupiter. Like, he is reveling in all of the death that he has wreaked there. So I can only imagine that he's not too worried about his weapon being dust free, but
yeah,
I don't know.
I thought that was great. I thought it was a great, I think he's a fine antagonist. As with many of these movies, by the time we get to the big finale, there ends up being a lot of screaming and running around.
Yes.
And I'm not sure it ends on the strongest note.
Because eventually he does end up on Venus. He's got two young men. He's trading the Venusians for a new young man to be their king, and taking the body of their previous one who had passed away back to Earth to his family so that they can bury him. And so he's there with Johnny R, who is the one that he picked up in Jupiter to trade. On the way, though, he does stop in the barn as a hideout with a creepy looking old dude. And that's where he ends up with Bodysuit. And they're ready to get done with Bodysuit because he's such an idiot. They were hoping he would be more useful to them, but he's just the worst. And so they just want to get rid of him. So he ends up with these two. He's going to trade Johnny R, but Johnny R doesn't really want to go. And so he trades Bodysuit. And then we end up in this situation where Professor Hess also happens to be on Venus. And we end up with this, the trade of Bodysuit instead of Johnny R. And Professor Hess is very upset about that because that wasn't what he was expecting. He wanted to kill Johnny R. And I'm not exactly sure what his plans were at that point. And then it's just like the women are all chasing Bodysuit around. He's chasing them because they got the wrong man, essentially. And that's kind of it. And then our hero gets to leave with the body. And it felt like they weren't exactly sure how to make the ending work right. And so they kind of came up with something that it did check the boxes, but it didn't give me the fulfilling ending that I was hoping for with Professor Hess.
Well, and I think that's it. Like, I think the other layer is they realized they needed to check all the boxes, and they probably, it just felt like they didn't really care. Realized they didn't need to care as much because they earned a lot for me leading up to the end, that I was just kind of in it a little bit for the parade. It is one of those don't stop and think about it kind of sequences, but I ended up having a good time with it anyway.
Yeah. Oh, I had a great time with it. I do wish that they had come up with a little stronger punch at the end with sorting out how to resolve everything between Professor Hess and our hero. You know, it's not quite there, but on the whole, they did a great job otherwise, kind of building up to everything. And so I did have a lot of fun with it.
So the just in terms of cast, I mean, it surprises me just how, you know, how many people came out of this movie who are doing stuff that isn't this movie.
Well, Corey McAbee's kind of continued the band, continued making Well, actually, I think the band ended in like 2011, 2012, Bill Nair show. Yeah. But he has continued performing, doing a lot of very much this sort of film music that it has kind of this interactive sense to it. Is there something interesting about what Corey's been doing? But as far as the actors, you're right. I mean, do you have any that are like, oh, I totally, like when you were watching this, I totally recognize that person?
Well, James Ransone, of course, is one of the big ones because, I mean, he went on to do a bunch of stuff, not the least of which is It, but he's been in a lot of other things that I have seen. Black Phone, he's the It movies.
He's in 12 episodes of The Wire. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. So, I mean, he's got a pretty legit career out of this thing. It was fun to see Annie Golden too. Annie Golden was in what was the HBO prison women prison show?
Orange is the New Black.
Yeah, Orange is the New Black.
Or is that that's not HBO? Is it that's or is that AMC?
Well, now I don't know.
But that's the one you're talking about. That
it show. Was a big streamer. Yeah, right. Orange is the New Black. So like some of these, it's just really fun to see these people have serious careers elsewhere. In a movie that I would expect none of them to. I would have expected this movie to have been, you know, made on a shoestring. I think this must go straight to Corey McAbee's Rolodex and charisma.
Well, and this was a film that, you know, Corey had already had a bit of an in with Sundance, having done a short film called The Bill Nair Chronicles. That played at Sundance in 95, and it was a multimedia event. And this was his first feature. He wrote it in 96, and then he was accepted into the Sundance Screenwriters Lab with this. And so with that, a lot of these, anytime we've talked about a film that has gone through the Sundance, either the Screenwriters Lab or one of their labs, in general, Sundance does a really good job of connecting them to people in the industry who are kind of mentoring them through the process. They end up getting connections to different actors and crew to kind of be part of their projects and everything. Like Mott Hupful, who shot this, you know, did The Savages a few years later and has done quite a number of bigger indie films. And so I think that's one of those things. You see some of these faces, and I think that's probably where Corey ended up getting those connections, was through having this. Like, that's the real benefit of being part of the Sundance Labs, is that you're getting all those connections to get to help your project come to fruition.
Well, I think this movie is a testament to exactly that, because these people are generally really great. You know, Rocco Sisto, again, a lot of TV, but you know, 63 credits.
A lot of movies too, like all the way back to like After Hours and
right.
Far and Away, you know, a lot of little bit parts, but has been there in a lot of movies through the 80s, 90s leading up to this.
He was young junior soprano in The Sopranos.
And it's interesting because the faces that we're seeing in here, when I watched this, I didn't recognize any of them.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I was looking a little more, I'm like, oh, okay, like Rocco Sisto. Okay, a face that seems somewhat familiar, but probably because he's a that guy in lots of other movies and TV. And I think that's where I was. I would never been able to pinpoint bodysuit. It's too hard to tell with the gimp suit on, you know, but still, when you go, oh, that was the kid from It, you know, it's like, it's nice to kind of have those little connections. But, you know, it was nice to see that Corey was able to get a number of interesting faces for a lot of these parts and cast them well. Like, that was something I also enjoyed, was they ended up feeling like they actually fit into this world. They didn't feel like he was just putting them in roles because he got a name that he was excited about. It's like, oh, okay, like I can see that person as the head of the Jupiter Mining Company or whatever. Like, they all kind of fit. Or the old guy in the bar.
Yeah, right. Old guy in the bar, that was Tom Aldridge. And do you have a memory of Tom Aldridge? Because Tom Aldridge got credits.
I don't have a memory of Tom Aldridge.
Well, I don't have a long history of Tom Aldridge. He was also in The Sopranos, so we got a couple of Sopranos vets. But mostly what I know him as is Uncle Pete in Damages, which was an awesome show that was really dark and made me feel dirty at the end of it. But it was the Glenn Close, Rose Byrne. She was the young attorney, and he was Uncle Pete, and was kind of the cleaner up guy. And I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah, he's been in lots of things, lots of different film, TV.
Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. That's a very high movie for me.
Who's in Batteries Not Included?
Yep.
Loved that one. What about Bob? You know, it's just, he's a person who's in all sorts of stuff. So, you know, and, you know, these character actors, like you find these great character actors and you put them in a movie like this and it just, it works. And having him do that little thing that he does about, is it just me or my balls itchy? Like that thing that he keeps doing. And then that joke, oh my God, that joke was like, what is happening right now?
I don't know why this is funny.
It's like all the parts that aren't the laugh lines, everybody is cracking up at. And then the parts where it's like a laugh line, they're just completely silent. So strange. It was just so weird. But, and then at the end, he's just like, you know, I've never understood this joke.
Yeah. Well, and this is why I go back to like, and before we started talking, I kind of likened it to my fandom of Hunter S. Thompson and Laurie Anderson and their collaborations in the 90s. And that sort of like old school performance art, that's where this is born. Like this is born out of weirdly alt slam poetry coffee houses. It's born out of the kind of wit and you know, absurdity that comes out of these places that I think it's chronicled kind of perfectly on screen for that vibe. And Surviving Desire has kind of a similar thing, even though it's not black and white and it's told in a bookshop. The way it's written, the things that I find funny and the way it moves in and out of humor and dance numbers, I think it has that same sort of kind of contaminant to my brain. Right? Like it gets stuck and I find myself thinking about it a lot. So I don't even know. I've got the movie playing here next to me and I feel like we could go round and round scene by scene, but the one thing that you've already tossed that I think we need to litigate a little bit is the framing device and the voiceover.
It was interesting because we do have the villain, Professor Hess, and it makes sense. He's a professor. It's a very professorial voiceover that we have starting off describing the universe. We get a map of the solar system and kind of setting up this world. But my favorite bit of voiceover that we have is when he's at the bar on Ceres and he sees Samuel go up to the counter and then the blueberry pirate, the blueberry pirate joins him and the two of them start having a conversation about the plans. And the way that we get his narration as he's watching from afar of what's going on, but he's doing it in a way where he's just like, oh, and now I bet they're saying this and this is what they're going to talk about. Like it was describing it in a way that, for a voiceover, I'm like, this is a really interesting way to get the exposition across because he's bitter, he's angry, he's speculating. He was right. I mean, it all was just telling us what was going on, but it was done in a way where it also felt so much character piece because it was giving us a sense of who this character is and just the way that he's stewing on all of this.
Yeah, and talk about a splinter. Like watching this sequence, I am thrown back and forth between learning so much good stuff about the identity of our narrator, who turns out to be our true antagonist, and also wanting him to shut up so I could hear what those guys say, and then going back and saying, well, what does it matter what they're saying? Who cares? Like what they're saying doesn't matter right now. I'm getting this other angle already. I just bounce back and forth between those two sort of perspectives. And I think it really, really works. I love that the narrator gets to push identity through the narration and push perspective more than just here's what's happening on screen. I think that was a perfect way to handle this voiceover. Perfect. 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 More should do that. The kid in Soul Food should have been more opinionated, right? Like that's what we need.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, in the scope of narration, when it is coming from a character in the story, having mm-hmm. that perspective does really help. It's a personal perspective. I like that. And maybe that's why stuff like Eve's Bayou works so well, because it is a very personal exploration, like looking back on their own memories and everything.
Yeah. Well, and telling us stuff we don't know. And that's the bottom line is this is, I learned something about the narrator antagonist, Professor Hess, that I didn't know before as a result of this. And this was a really efficient way to give me that insight.
Yeah. We've talked already about the cinematography and how much we liked the look of this stark black and white in this film. We didn't mention, and I did mention that Mott Hupful III is the cinematographer of the film. I wonder if he is a third, or as we've learned with thirds, if both his father and grandfather are both still alive, or if he's been dropped to a second or first by now.
To all the thirds, we both regret and are delighted to inform you that you might be a second.
That's right. What a weird thing to have learned over the course of Marvel Movie Minute episode. The whole idea of thirds.
That's a show that keeps giving, Andy. Yeah, it just keeps on giving.
I tell you. But we have talked about Mott Hupful before when we talked about the notorious Betty Page. That was the very next project that Mott worked on. About that in our series when we were looking at the film of Mary Harron. Very interesting director, interesting film, wasn't one of my favorites, but the look, I mean, that was another film playing with like color and black and white and stuff and doing some interesting things. So I generally like Mott Hupful's cinematography. Any other specific thoughts about the work here or Mott?
I thought the use of camera in this thing was amazing. We'd be watching just kind of the shots that I was interested in walking into the bar, and then we'd get shots that I was downright shocked I was watching in a movie like this. Incredible focus pulls, using black and white to highlight just incredible highlights and a black point that is infinite, infinitely dark. Like, I just thought that the way the camera showcased macro elements and odd angles, and I mean, he was having a ball. I just felt like he was having a ball with the camera on this movie.
Two other shots that stood out to me just in the construction, the lighting and the construction. One is in the, and they're both in the bar. One is earlier on, and it's when, and I can't remember the specifics. I think it's when Samuel comes in and is talking to, I can't remember, but it's just a shot of the wall, and then you're watching their silhouettes, the two silhouettes as they have their conversation. You, like, finding ways to allow a scene to play out where we don't necessarily need to be cutting back and forth or seeing the people themselves was so fascinating. Oh, and the other is when he delivers the cat to the bartender in the back room, and the shot, you're staring at the cat container, and they slide it back and forth, and as they slide it, it reveals one or the other of their silhouettes as they're talking on the wall behind. And then they take it down, they put up the other box that has the woman in it, they open it up, they slide it, and it's this single shot, and you're getting the silhouettes of the two people sometimes, and sometimes you're getting the object they're talking about. It's fascinating. Like, just really creative use of camera throughout this film.
So just a use of prop, sidebar on the prop.
Yeah.
The real girl in the tank briefcase. Unsettling. I just think that was weird and unsettling.
What is this universe where they can grow a woman? Like, use this to grow her, and then she can be your sex slave, basically. It's like, what right. is going on in this? Yeah.
Well, in that shot that you're talking about, the side-by-side shot, they zoom in on the, or there's, it's a close shot on the viewing window.
Right.
And they open the viewing window, and it's like music, right? It's like it's a music box.
It's and a blobby, liquidy something.
Liquidy, blobby thing that I think there's a tentacle involved.
I don't know if there's a tentacle, but I may be
but
wrong.
But again, yeah. We've already acknowledged the movie is mushy on YouTube. So
yes,
it may have been a tentacle. It may have been more blobby mushy. But it was, I think that was a fantastic thing because there, I mean, look at how much is layered on our intentional like load. We are keeping track of this conversation between these two guys, and we're now introduced to this prop that is, they're telling us it's a girl.
that you can grow into a real woman, and it comes out like an amorphous blob with a tentacle potentially. And that is hard to bring into that one shot. They're asking a lot. And in the end, is there a MacGuffin involved? Like, I don't know. I think maybe not. I think we do need to pay attention to where all these, this is essentially a three card Monty game, right? Like he keeps having to switch these, deliver these goods. We kind of need to know what the goods are, and so that he can get to the last station.
Yeah. It was such a strange, it just all ties into this strange world. The fact that we're in this alternate solar system where they can grow a woman in this tube. And they pulled it, like the bartender pulled it from his own DNA. And they're like, well, make sure you don't tell the don't tell the people on Jupiter that.
Like, and then they proceed to let the bartender demonstrate that maybe his DNA isn't the one you want to showcase.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's the bartenders who's fronting the band for the dance contest. And we actually do get a little bit of dance contest, like of all these, dudes dancing. I thought that was just a really great. It's a weirdly subversively progressive movie for 2001.
Yeah. Such a strange little thing, but one I really enjoyed.
It was as we discussed, shot on 35mm film stock. Maccabee edited the thing himself. He had a Steinbeck flatbed in his apartment.
Old school, actual splicing, cutting and splicing.
Yep, old school. Yeah, yeah,
that's great.
I know those are your favorite days. Those days.
There is something magical about cutting film. I will say it is an interesting process.
Those were the sound effects. A lot of it was done using some truly vintage analog synthesizers and found sounds. Like it sounds like the sound bed or soundscape was really meticulously put together, and you can hear it. I thought it was wonderful. The music, the Billy Nair show we talked about, the songs were recorded live on set during filming, which, how you feel about recording live on set depends on sort of the kind of jam you have and the kind of experience you have playing live. But he had a controlled set and he has lots of experience doing live shows, and that seemed to make a lot of sense. I think it turned out just straight up ingenious.
Yeah, no, it's a very clever, unique thing. And, like some actual songs, and then you have the one where they're like, it's the songbook and they're looking at that song Rio Yeti. Like one of them is just like Rio Yeti, you, and the other was no, like,
yeah,
what a weird little scene,
because they were starting it on the wrong syllable, right? Yo Rio Yeti. Yeah, I like, they were, it wasn't right. There was something wrong about it. and then they would switch parts and take turns screaming.
And that's the song, apparently.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah
Strange. I don't know if that one has ever been released.
I don't know. It's a very performative moment in the film.
Yeah.
That was very funny. And clearly Bodysuit was actually getting into it.
Oh God. Rincon. Everybody in here just totally committed to the bit, right? People with lots of credits behind their names jumping into this thing and totally committed to the bit. I think it's an exuberant expression of fun in filmmaking. Is it a 5-star heart movie? I don't know. We'll see. But whatever it is, and I think I texted you this. Andy, I don't know what I'm watching here. I don't know if I love it or hate it, but I absolutely love watching it. And that, I think, is a real testament to a fun film. Great film.
Well, it makes me wonder what the future is for this strange little movie. Like, are they going to try doing any sort of better release at some point? Or is Corey just kind of like moved on and past it now? I just don't know. There is the AmericanAstronaut.com website where you can buy a lot of things that Corey has done. Some of them are digital, some of the other projects like Stingray Sam, but not the American Astronaut. You can buy the DVD still of that film, which is 640 by 480, even in the iTunes compatible version of it. But it does make me wonder, it shot on 35. Like, this seems like this would be a great film to do some sort of an upgrade with.
Sure.
So I don't know. I hope so, because I would love to see this nice and clean. I think it would be a beautiful film to look at. And it's just, it would be a really fun one to revisit.
I 100% agree.
Yeah.
Great.
Anything else, or should we plug on forward?
I say we plug forward.
All right.
Well, we're going to try and make that a thing. Yeah,
so plug on forward.
Hey, everybody, plug forward.
All right, we'll be right back, but first, our credits.
The Next Reel is a production of True Story FM, engineering by Andy Nelson, music by Ofer Koren and Randy Sharp, Oriel Novella, and Eli Kaplan. Andy usually finds all the stats for the awards and numbers at the-numbers.com, boxofficemojo.com, imdb.com, and wikipedia.org. Who knows what he'll find this week? You can find the show at truestory.fm, and if your podcast app allows ratings and reviews, please consider doing that for our show. Andy, can you believe we've almost hit 700 episodes of The Next Reel?
I know, it's crazy. And with all the other episodes in our family of podcasts, we are well over 1,200 episodes of movie conversation. It's really pretty amazing that we've gotten to have these in-depth movie chats every week for over a decade now.
And we couldn't have done it without our loyal community of film fans. Their support over the years has meant so much.
For sure. That reminds me, we should give the merch store a shout-out. Buying shirts from thenextreel.com/merch is a great way listeners can continue to support the show. Plus, they get to sport our great designs.
Absolutely. I think sometimes folks forget we have a variety of shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more available. In fact, a great place to start is with a shirt sporting The Next Reel's logo.
We also have that classic Fast Times Spicoli Surf School tee, or the weirdly popular Rusty's European Tour shirt.
The one from National Lampoon's European Vacation. Why is that so popular?
Search me, but we have sold a ridiculous number of those. I guess there are a lot of Rusty's taking trips to Europe?
We're always adding new designs based on movies we've covered, like our brand new design for A Streetcar Named Desire, featuring a streetcar named Desire. So if you want to rep your love of TNR and films, head to thenextreel.com/merch.
Every purchase helps us continue to have these weekly in-depth conversations. So visit thenextreel.com/merch today.
And as always, thanks for listening and being a part of the Next Reel community. We've got lots more great movie chats coming your way. All right. So we go on the hunt for awards. Tell me it got something. It deserves something.
It did, although very limited release, very independent film. It's not going to get a lot of notice. Probably didn't have a lot of money to put into publicity. But still, it did get two wins with two other nominations. At the Florida Film Festival, it won Best Narrative Feature for its original vision. We're here talking about the Film Independent Spirit Awards. It was nominated for Best Cinematography, but it did lose to Memento, which we've talked about on the show before. But as I said, we'll re-release that into the feeds here soon. At the Kudzu Film Festival, it won the Audience Favorite Award. And then at the Sundance Film Festival, where it premiered, it was nominated for the Grand Jury Prize Dramatic, but lost to The Believer. This was Ryan Gosling's neo-Nazi movie that he did back then.
What a tough slate to compete against for a little movie like this.
Yeah, very much so.
Unreal. Speaking of tough competition, how to do at the box office?
Well, you said it, like many indie films, particularly ones that don't get much of a release, there isn't a whole lot out there for this particular film. I did find this website I've never heard of before called Alchatron or Alcatron. It's a social media website. It said that Maccabee had somewhere between 1 and 2 million, which for an indie film is a pretty broad spectrum, like a wide wow. range. I'm just going to say 2 million for our purposes here, which is about 3.6 million in today's dollars. The movie premiered at Sundance January 2001 and played at a few other festivals before an NYC debut September 21st and out in LA October 5th. Then a very, very, very limited release starting October 12th, 2001, opposite The Musketeer. Two can play that game, Rockstar and Soul Survivors. This did not make a dent at all, earning only $33,884 domestically. That is about $60,652 in today's dollars, leaving it with an adjusted loss per finished minute of $38,600. Still, this is, it doesn't happen often where I post that I watch something and I have a lot more people than I'm used to going, oh my God, that film, what a crazy little experience that was. Like, this is a film that sticks and certainly warrants a cult audience to really push for a bigger re-release.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would love to see this 4K.
Yeah. That would be gorgeous.
On the bigger screen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perfect.
Strange little film. And I'd love to, I guess you can buy the CD, the physical CD of the soundtrack. I did see on Amazon, but it would be a fun one too. This would be a fun one to have like in an actual theater. Like, yes. I just feel like the audience would really, really enjoy it.
You know, that Harkins, the Harkins freezer. I'd see it there.
That'd be fun. That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Great movie. We'll be right back for our ratings. But first, here's the trailer for next week's movie, Scott McGeehee's and David Siegel's The Deep End.
Mr. Reese, I want you to stay away from my son.
I thought that was your little secret.
There are some secrets.
He's my friend. That's all.
That can never be told.
Well, he may not be the friend you think he is.
He's dead. He was killed, and now he was here.
There are some mysteries.
You're saying someone murdered him.
Do you think the police will want to speak with you?
That should never be solved.
I came to talk about Darby Reese and your son.
What exactly is it you want?
And there are some choices.
Your son's been spending a lot of time with Mr. Reese. Special time.
That come with a price.
$50,000 by tomorrow, or there'll be a copy with the Tahoe police.
Or do you expect me to get $50,000 in 24 hours?
That's the position you're in.
Tilda Swinton's performance is a thing of beauty.
I just want to know what happened.
Do we have to talk about this now? Just let it go.
A stunningly tight and evocative thriller.
I want that money.
It is not the kind of thing that everyone can just go out and get.
Mesmerizing, elegantly shot, and exquisitely made.
I don't think you're really trying.
How would you be really trying to find this $50,000 you've come here to steal from me?
Tilda Swinton creates a masterful performance.
I'm not sure you understand the situation.
Maybe I should take a page from your book. Maybe I should blackmail someone.
And Goran Vishnik gives a remarkable performance.
Just keep your family away.
Once she looks beneath the surface.
What's going on?
It's not what you think.
How do you know what I think?
She doesn't know where it will lead.
I asked you to handle this. You did not.
Who it will touch.
If I could make him go away, I would.
Why are you doing this?
Or how deep it will go.
Margaret, stop!
I'm sorry for all of this.
We have no choice now.
Fox Searchlight Pictures presents...
I can put an end to this, to all of this.
Whatever happened that night is over. To hold this behind you as if it never happened.
The Deep End.
Mandy, it's for you.
It is hard to believe we've been having in-depth weekly conversations about movies since 2011.
You're telling me producing this show week after week is so much fun, but it does require a lot of work behind the scenes. If you'd like to help support our efforts, one easy way is by using our Originals page when shopping for books and movies that we've covered.
Your purchases made through our links give us a small commission at no extra cost to you and allow us to keep having these great discussions.
The Originals page at thenextreel.com/originals links to the source material for all of our adapted film discussions. Purchasing through our links supports the show.
In season 13, we explore various awards categories and the films nominated in them.
We wrapped up our 1940 Best Picture series with adaptations of Mice and Men from John Steinbeck and Wuthering Heights from Emily Bronte's novel, not to mention the play Dark Victory by George Brewer Jr. and Bertram Block.
The 1947 Academy Award adapted screenplay series featured Anna and the King of Siam, based on Margaret Langdon's book, plus The Best Years of Our Lives, Brief Encounter, and The Killers.
The 1952 cinematography nominees included Death of a Salesman and A Streetcar Named Desire, A Place in the Sun, based on both a play and a book, and Strangers on a Train, based on Patricia Highsmith's first novel.
So many great movies based on books and plays, like Beckett, The Pumpkin Eater,
A Boy and His Dog, Rollerball,
The Princess Bride, Congo, The Scarlet Letter,
Jackie Brown, The Deep End, The Gray, The Woman in Black,
and Top Gun Maverick, which I'm very much looking forward to revisiting.
Get the source books at thenextreel.com/originals.
Start your next read or reread from the movies we've covered. Visit thenextreel.com/originals today. Letterboxd, Andy. Oh, Letterboxd for this movie. Oh, is it going to be tricky or fun?
or tricky and fun. This was, it is a tricky one to rate. I mean, I do have issues with the film, like we talked about with the end. It just kind of, it didn't quite hold up.
Limps.
Yeah, yeah, through that last bit. But I had such a wonderful time watching this strange world that was being created here. This is like a great movie that I feel the 3.5 rating works well for this zone of film that I enjoy. It's not a perfect film, but there's something just I love about those experiences.
Yeah, I think so too. I think the real question for me is, as a no half stars guy, like, is it 3 stars but a much bigger heart or 4 stars? Either way, it's getting a heart. Who are we kidding? Yeah. I really enjoyed my time with this movie, but you know, between 3 and 4 stars, like I think I have to go 4. And that, I don't want to look at any of the other movies that I've rated 4 stars after I do that. Like, I'm just going to close my eyes and walk away. But I think I'm going to go 4 stars. Four stars. Crazy?
Hey.
There's kind of a second question, though. And it's something that JJ and Steve used to do regularly on Trailer Rewind, which I think was a really nice addition to their show and a good addition to this movie. Who in your life do you think you would recommend this movie to?
It's funny that you say that, because the first person I was like, I have to tell Steve to watch this.
I know.
This just seemed so right up his alley.
Yeah.
It's a quirky one. I think my sister would enjoy it. I think this is one I could tell my sister to check out. I think she'd have fun with it. Not one for the parents. I don't think that they would get into this kind of strangeness. Yeah. It's for people who can appreciate a strange level of comedy in kind of that, with that independent spirit. It's more of my film friends than family.
Yeah. Independent spirit. You might think you would nominate it for an award if one so existed.
Right. For that independent spirit.
I think, you know, it's interesting. My son is coming into movies, you know, and he wants to, he's really thinking a lot about his relationship with movies and telling stories on film, and he's shooting his first short right now. I think he might actually truck with it. I think it's funny enough that I think it'll get it, and weird enough that I think it'll get by the, you know, old school black and white. I think that's the thing where I'm working with my son a little bit, just like, hey, film existed before, you know, YouTube shorts.
Yeah, right.
So,
and there's something to be said for black and white. Like,
yeah,
I know some people are like, oh, it just already looks old and boring, but there doesn't have to be.
It really, really doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
Okay.
Lots of fun with this one. Glad we added it to the list. Looking forward to the series. So what did you think about The American Astronaut? We would love to hear your thoughts on this one. Hop into the Show Talk channel over in our Discord community, where we will be talking about the movie this week.
When the movie ends,
our conversation begins.
Letterboxd giveth, Andrew.
As Letterboxd always doeth.
I've got one. It's a little bit, it's not long. I mean, it's got words. So let me, can I go first? It's a 5-star too.
Do it.
All right. It's very enthusiastic from Findlay. Revisionist industrial era filmmaking posing as a musical sci-fi. This is what it would be like if not only the moon landing was faked, but if it existed in its own purse of absurd existence that we opened up whenever we needed it. Could be perceived as an Oingo Boingo experiment into making Le Voyage dans la Lune, but if at the end of it was the Mos Eisley Cantina with old-time blues, rock and roll, and other blue-eyed American greatisms being parodied into oblivion, but coming back full circle and sounding amusing, rousing, and totally perfect. I think the people involved were trying to make a weird midnight movie, but what they ended up making was a steam-powered blues musical version of Star Wars that would play in miners' clubs in burning pictures of the original incarnations of your hometown. I think that's lovely.
That is, yeah.
I like it.
Steam-powered, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
There's like a weird steampunk sort of vibe to it.
For sure.
A lot of people giving a lot of comparisons to different things, like our own Nick Langdon, one of our wonderful members, who says, what if David Lynch had been hired to direct Dark Star? Very much. Another one, Sarah Zedig, says Flash Gordon by way of La Jetée and David Lynch with a little Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man in there for good measure. I don't always get it, but I love it. But I'm going to just stick with Sam B's 3.5 and a heart, which says it so perfectly. Sometimes movies are just the best, which, I mean, come on. Love it.
I will also shout, I mean, Nick's review is extensive, and also watch this as a mini collab with Moshi Minyan, whose review is also quite good. And so both of those are great reads if you want to see some more contribution to the critique of the film.
Absolutely.
That's it. Thanks, Letterboxd. You did great.
I've been podcasting since 2006. In that time, I've tried countless hosting platforms, but in August 2022, we switched to Transistor to power all of our shows here at True Story FM, and it's been a game changer.
I love that Transistor allows unlimited podcasts and storage without extra charges. We can publish so much content, and we do. If you want to start up a podcast, do yourself a favor and host your show on Transistor.
With their one-click publishing, you can get your new show onto all the major podcast directories effortlessly.
And their website builder lets you quickly build custom sites for each show.
The detailed analytics are invaluable, too. You can access all kinds of listener data anytime.
Oh, and the versatile players allow you to embed episodes anywhere to reach new listeners. Plus, the team behind Transistor is super responsive and keeps making the platform even better.
After using countless hosting services over 15-plus years, Transistor has been, hands down, the best podcast partner for us.
If you want a hosting platform to take all the worry out of getting your podcast out into the world, go to thenextreel.com/transistor and check it out.
Support our show and support your own show by going to thenextreel.com/transistor. Start growing your podcast today.